From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Garden looks nice, I said, super clear. Abnesi said, Jeff, how about we pep up those language centers? Sure, I said. Drip on, he said. Acknowledge, I said. He added some verbaloose to the drip, and soon I was feeling the same things but saying them better. The garden still looked nice. It was like the bushes were so tight-seeming and the sun made everything stand out. It was like any moment you expected some Victorians to wander in with their cups of tea. It was as if the garden had become a sort of embodiment of the domestic dreams forever intrinsic to human consciousness. It was as if I could suddenly discern, in this contemporary vignette, the ancient corollary through which Plato and some of his contemporaries might have strolled. To wit, I was sensing the eternal in the ephemeral.
That's George Saunders with an excerpt from his short story, Escape from Spiderhead. It's from his new book, 10th of December. We'll meet Saunders in just a moment as we explore the art of the short story. Karen Russell will also join us to talk about her new story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And writer Tom Perata tells us how he selected the 20 best American short stories of 2012. But first, George Saunders. Dave Eggers says there's no one better, no one more essential to our national sense of self and sanity. Saunders has been getting a lot of these kinds of accolades lately. But he wasn't always a literary star. His resume includes stints as a technical writer and a geophysical engineer. Now, he's widely considered one of America's great short story writers. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Saunders to talk about his new collection, 10th of December.
It's great to have you here. And I have to ask about that recent New York Times Magazine cover story titled, George Saunders has written the best book you'll read this year, which was flattering, obviously. But
yeah.
Do you feel any extra pressure now when you sit down to write because of all the raves you've been getting?
Well, luckily, I haven't sat down to write since that headline. I think as long as everyone just agrees not to read for the next 11 months, we'll be fine.
Yeah. So this has been all good. I mean, you've gotten really glowing reviews so far.
Yeah, it really has been fun. And, you know, I've got a certain impulse to kind of act like I'm conflicted about it, but it's actually just been a riot. Been doing some traveling and meeting so many nice people. I kind of felt like that headline was kind of an ornery, hyperbolic throwdown a little bit. And I thought, all right, well, let's just see what happens. And it's been just been a lot of fun.
Well, let me ask about this new collection of stories, 10th of December, which is your fourth collection. And it comes, what, 7 years after your last book in
right.
Persuasion Nation. Do you think your writing has changed since your last book?
I think it has been changing all along, yeah. To me, it's sort of a continuum. And it's been going in the direction of maybe opening up a little bit or becoming a little more, I don't know if it's gentle. I mean, it's still a pretty dark book, but I know there were times in it when maybe in the last book I would have taken the swerve towards the catastrophic thing. And then this book, I found myself looking a little harder to see if I could steer it away from that cliff. I'm not sure why. Maybe just having steered left so many times, you sort of feel like the place of maximum aesthetic interest is to try to go the other direction.
Well, you're often described as a satirist, kind of along the lines of Kurt Vonnegut. But it strikes me that maybe you're becoming a little less satirical and, I don't know, sort of moving into new emotional territory.
I think that's how it felt. Although, you know, honestly, I never really considered my fiction to be satire. I got kind of tagged with that early. And, you know, when you're a young writer, you're just happy to be tagged with anything. So I kind of learned to take it. But I never really felt they were satire. Because to me, satire kind of means there's an object on there, you know how you feel about it, and you're going to give it a kick. And the stories always felt to me, they felt funny, you know, and kind of maybe there was some irony in there. But satire, there were satirical elements. Sometimes I would, under the guise of taking a poke at advertising, something would happen. But for me, the interesting thing was always kind of, you know, the traditional story form. And my aim was always emotional, at least to me it was. So the satire thing, I never felt totally easy with it, but I think you're exactly right that the emotional core of this book is much closer to the surface, I think.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that came up in that New York Times Magazine profile was the question of what it means to be a writer for our time, for this particular historical moment. And I'm wondering if that's something that really weighs on you. I mean, do you think about what the demands of a creative writer are now? I mean, how they're different now than they might have been 20 or 30 years ago?
No, it's funny because when you have a book out, you end up talking about it as if you were in control of it or you had certain intentions. And for me, most of the time, I'm just trying to not fall off the wall, basically, you know, walking along this brick wall that is being interesting in a story and just trying to stay on the wall. So for me, for whatever reason, that place is more comfortable if I'm not conceptualizing too much about anything. Like to think about my role would be paralyzing, or to think about, even to think about the story form in a more intellectual or critical way is actually really harmful for me. So I've kind of developed through sort of trial and error this approach. It's really, there's almost nothing to it. It's kind of a process of being in close relation to your own text in revision. And probably the most I could say about it is you're trying to steer the story towards a place of maximum energy, knowing that if you do that, all this other stuff will happen. You'll get theme and politics and emotional content and all that. But I won't get it unless I'm concentrating on the text as simply as I can.
I'm struck by that phrase you used, there's almost nothing to it. It seems like there's a lot to it.
Well, I mean, there's not much to be said about it. You
know? Okay.
I think it's a little bit maybe like, I imagine, you know, improvising in music or playing a sport. There's physics going on and there's a lot to be said about it, but in the moment of doing it, you're actually doing a kind of intuitive thing. And in writing, at least my process, it's based on an intuitive, instantaneous assessment of the text that you're reading that you've also just written, and then sort of like a seasoning to taste, and then doing that hundreds of times in revision. And then slowly the thing starts to take shape and to mean something. But my experience early in my writing career was when I had a plan, I would have the terrible failure of exactly fulfilling that plan, which was a disappointment for everybody. So now it's much more a process of kind of looking at a story with real curiosity and saying, what do you want to do? You know, where would you like me to go? And then trying to keep the lines clear so I can actually hear what's coming back at me from the text.
Well, I think anyone who reads your fiction will recognize a very distinct Saunders aesthetic. I mean, I certainly do. And I was struck by one of the reviews of your book in Harper's by Tom Bissell, who wrote, "The Saunders secret appears to be beginning with the hidebound conventions of more traditionally sleepy literary fiction and injecting 50 cc's of absurdist sci-fi."
That was a nice line.
Do you think he got that right?
He did get it right, although the way that actually happens is a little less deliberate. I mean, it's mostly you're writing along, the story's doing something, but you start to feel discontent with whatever it's doing. You feel like somehow it stayed static for too long, or the reader knows what's coming next and what you had planned to give is just that, and suddenly you're in danger of being a bore. So it's just somehow you're looking for a means to shake up the language and keep it fresh. For me, that often means, you know, put in the theme park. Or in this book, there's a couple of stories where I just made up these drugs to give the characters so that their diction would go into a different register. But again, for me, that all falls under the rubric of trying to keep the prose kind of zingy, you know, trying to keep some energy in the prose with the confidence that if you do that, all the other good things will happen on their own.
Well, I have to ask you about one of the stories, the longest story in your book, the Semplica Girl Diaries, which would certainly seem to fit this bill of absurdist sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the story.
Well, that one was kind of unusual because the whole thing came out of a dream that I had. These Semplica girls are kind of, I don't know if I should give it away, but they're basically this kind of freaky lawn ornament. And I dreamed them. I could see them clearly in the backyard of our house in Syracuse. And it's a very disturbing image. But in the dream, the person I was just kind of grateful. I felt like, oh, finally we arrived. We could put these lawn ornaments in our yard. The kids will be so happy. So waking up from that dream, you're kind of like, wow, what the heck is that about?
We should describe what these lawn ornaments are in your story. I mean, they are real people.
Yeah. In the dream, there are four women that in the dream logic I understood to be third world women, alive, perfectly happy, wearing these matching beautiful white sort of gowns or smocks, all had long flowing black hair. And there was a wire that went, you know, like into the left side of their head and out the right side. So the four of them were all suspended on this string, kind of like paper dolls. And they were sort of on this swing set type apparatus, and it was all flowers growing around it and a little waterfall. And it was just this feeling of, oh, finally, we got ours.
Because everyone else, all the neighbors, the more well-to-do neighbors, had their Semplica girls. And finally, this one family gets their own. So they can...
That's right.
They don't have to feel embarrassed.
the kids were mildly embarrassed to go to school because they didn't. So, but it was such a complete dream. It was, you know, the emotional content was all there and the visual image was there. So I remember reading somewhere that Faulkner had written, I think The Sound and the Fury. He'd driven by a house and he saw this older boy helping a girl into a tree and he had his hand kind of on her panties. And Faulkner wrote the book trying to figure out what that image meant or who the people were. So it was kind of the same thing. I just had this dream that I tried to deny it, but I just kept thinking about it. So then you kind of consent to it and go, all right, let's figure out how this world happens.
Don't you wonder where that dream came from?
Oh, yeah. It's really intriguing because it was a very smart dream. It had a lot of complications in it, and I could never in a million years think that up. I wouldn't want to think it up. I'd be kind of ashamed to have thought it up. But, you know, there it was, just fully intact. And then when I unpacked it, which took me 12 years, you know, you find that it's actually intimately related to the life that I was living at that time, which was full of that kind of struggle for money and slight feelings of class anxiety for the family and the whole thing. So it's really intriguing.
It took you 12 years to write this story?
It did, yeah.
Wow. Why did it take so long?
I don't know. I mean, it was partly just that when you hear that image, I think most people would think, oh, that's a story about oppression of the third world, which it is. So I think part of the challenge was if that's what the story ended up being, then it's not enough somehow. It's kind of like a lecture or something. So part of the thing was to say, okay, yeah, of course it's about that. You know, any story with that image in it is going to have that component. But then saying, well, what else is it about? And hopefully that thing isn't reducible. You know, the story becomes an object in the world rather than a lesson. So that was a part of it. And then also just practically, I kind of got to a certain point in the story where I just wasn't quite sure who the hero was. The father of the story is a pretty good guy. He kind of thinks, I would say, pretty much correctly about the world, except he's got this blind spot, as does the rest of the culture about these girls. So it was just kind of trying to see where's the story going to go. And of course, lots of pages of writing backstory to find out how do these girls arrive, where do they stay, what's the economic setup, is there a warranty, you know, all that kind of stuff. So,
could you read an excerpt from this story?
Sure. It's in diary form, so that's a little minimalistic, and this is just a description of the birthday party. September 21st, Lily B. Day. There are days so perfect you feel this is what life about. When old, will feel whole life worth it because I got to experience this perfect day. Today, that kind of day. Maybe too excited to tell in order, plus tired after a long great day, but we'll try. In morning, kids go off to school per usual. Greenway comes at 10. Nice guys, big guys, one with mohawk. Yard done by 2. Roses in, fountain in, pathway in. SG truck arrives at 3. SG's exit truck stands shyly near fence while rack installed. Rack nice. Opted for Lexington. Mid-range in terms of price. Bronze uprights with colonial caps, easy release levers. SG's already in white smocks. Microline already strung through. SG's holding microline slack in hands like mountain climbers holding rope, only no mountain. One squatting, other standing polite, nervous, one sniffing new roses. She gives timid wave. Other says something to her like saying, hey, not supposed to wave. But I wave back like saying, in this household, is okay to wave. Doctor monitors installation by law, so young. Looks like should be working at Wendy's. Says we can watch hoist or not. Gives me meaningful look, cuts eyes at Pam as in wife squeamish. Pam somewhat squeamish. Sometimes does not like to handle raw chicken. I say, let's go inside, put candles on cake. Soon, knock on door. Doctor says, hoist all done. Me, so can we have a look? Him, totally. We step out. SG's up now, approximately 3 feet off ground, smiling, swaying in slight breeze. Order, left to right. Tammy, Laos. Gwen, Moldova. Lisa, Somalia. Betty, Philippines. Effect amazing. Having so often seen similar configurations in yards of others more affluent makes own yard seem suddenly affluent. You feel different about self, as if at last you are in step with peers and time in which living. Pond great, roses great, path, hot tub great, everything set. Could not believe we had pulled this off. Picked Lily up early at school. Lily all hangdog because her B-day and no one said happy B-day at breakfast and no party and no gifts so far, plus now has to go to doctor for shot because that was ruse. In car, pretended to be lost. Lily, discouraged. Daddy, how can you be lost when Haneke are doctor forever? Pam worked this out in advance with nurse, who, when I finally found office, came out, said the doctor was sick, too sick to give shot, the first of series of super surprises for Lily. Meanwhile at home, Pam, Thomas, Eva scrambled to decorate. Food delivered, barbecue from Snakey's. Friends arrive. So when Lily gets out of car, what does she see but a whole new yard full of all friends from school, sitting at new picnic table, near new hot tub. Note to self, write note praising kids for admirable restraint, keeping secret, and new line of 4SGs, and Lily literally burst into tears of happiness.
Wow, that is such a great passage, because you're doing so much there. In some ways, it's this utterly prosaic thing of, you know, this guy just writing in his diary, although in kind of this clip form of the diary, sort of, you know, what would seem to be kind of a mundane thing. And then you incorporate this whole bizarre detail of these live women being strung up as lawn ornaments and somehow putting it all together.
Well, I think that was one of the things that took some time was when you first have an idea like that, you're always explaining it in the text, kind of to yourself. But then given the fact that it's a diary and given the fact that in his culture, these things aren't unusual at all, then you have to kind of dial back the references. It's like if we were, you know, writing a contemporary story that had a TV in it, you wouldn't have the aside where, you know, it says, Bill turned on the TV, which was a device that broadcast shows from all over the country. You know, you would just say TV. So part of the challenge was to kind of keep the reader leaning in, trying to figure out what these things were, but at the same time, be true to the conceit that for him, these things are second nature.
So what do you think makes a really great story? Not just a good story, but a great story, whether talking about one of yours or someone else's.
This will be kind of a dull answer, but I think there's a quality of efficiency where everything in the story is doing work, and where, in a perfect world, every motion of the story is increasing the energy. So I think of a story like Indian Camp by Hemingway, which is, if you study it closely, which we do at Syracuse, that thing never stops moving. It never stops morphing, even paragraph to paragraph. So that's a huge thing. And then maybe, though, at the very highest levels, I think there's something that you could never will this into a story, but there's a sense of love, of kind of a godlike mind at work who's kind of regarding his creations with a lot of love. So I think of The Overcoat by Nikolai Gogol, which is just, you know, obnoxious, funny, wild, really, really unpredictable story. But at the heart of it, you know, you can really feel God like shining through Gogol, but not in this kind of holy, boring, luminous way. You know, you can see the fibers in the coat and you can see the sweat on foreheads. I mean, I always feel like I'm looking for some person who can regard these characters in the book the way that maybe God does, you know, with that much acceptance and that sort of acuity of vision and that much forgiveness. And I, you know, so I think of Gogol or Dickens, Shakespeare, the way that there would be, everything was permitted on the stage that they were making and nothing was missed, but everything was sort of, you know, had a sort of glow about it. And I think that's what we really, that's what I really yearn for in stories.
George Saunders is the author of 10th of December. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Have you read any good short stories lately? Or would you rather be reading novels? We'd love to know what you think. You can get in touch with us through Facebook or Twitter, or send us an email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, what makes a great short story? Tom Perotta shares his thoughts as we continue our Hour on the Short Story. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. How many short stories have you read over the past year? Probably nowhere near the 120 stories that Tom Perotta read as editor for the Best American Short Stories 2012. Perotta has also written a lot of his own short stories, and he's the author of the novels Election and Little Children, both of which were made into films nominated for Academy Awards. So I figured Tom Perata would be the perfect choice to answer the question, what makes a great short story?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. You know, I think, and I really learned this when I edited Best American Short Stories, which required me to read, you know, quite widely in what had been published, was that you can have certain preconceptions about that, but it really is that old, I know it when I see it. You suddenly feel that excitement and that alertness and that need to know what happens next, or just that excitement to be hearing a voice that you've never heard before, or learning about a place or a person that you didn't think you'd ever meet. I mean, I think the one thing for me that's always been true is that there's a germ of an anecdote in a lot of the stories I like. I've always loved listening to people tell me interesting stories about what happened. And I think some of the stories I like best begin with what seems like a kind of a curious anecdote, and then uses that anecdote to reveal not only character in the moment, but the story of an entire life.
Short stories are such an extraordinary challenge. I know you've been writing for a long time, reading for a long time. Short stories demand that you do so much with so little, and you have to do it well because failure is waiting for you right around the corner, isn't it? If you don't tell the story now and in plain language, disaster is somewhere nearby.
It's true that it's a very unforgiving form. It does seem to me that stories that work have to be pretty close to perfect. I think the novel is a much more forgiving form. We just take it for granted that every novel we read will be flawed in a certain way, and that what we want really is just for the virtues of the novel to allow us to forgive those flaws. But if a story's flawed and you leave it for even a moment, I think it can be hard to get back into it. And I think it can be a very kind of delicate machine, a narrative machine that a writer's trying to create.
You, of course, were faced with quite a challenge putting together the Best American Short Stories for 2012. You had to read a lot, although I gather that there were a lot of stories that were taken out of contention before you started reading. Is that right?
That's right. So the way that the series is done, and it makes the guest editor's life a lot easier, is Heidi Pittler, who's the series editor, reads essentially everything. I believe reads stories in the thousands, and she narrows it down to a long list of 120, and the guest editor reads those 120 and picks 20. So it's a big job, but it's not a year-round, exhaustive job. So it's possible that there were stories that I didn't see that might end up on some alternate list. But even out of those 120, it was very hard for me to narrow it down to just 20. Heidi has very good taste, and there were a number of really great stories that I just couldn't fit into my list.
When you were reading them, did you find that there was a particular style that appealed to you, or were you trying to look for a variety of styles to represent the best American short stories?
You know, it's funny, because I told Heidi I was interested in seeing some comic stories because I felt like they were sometimes underrepresented, and I always enjoy a funny story. And she did try to do that, and what I discovered was that some stories that are self-consciously comic weren't working for me. And I ended up, I think, choosing stories that really moved me, and I discovered that that's really what I want from a story, is a kind of emotional experience, and those were the ones that really stuck with me. And so I think sometimes we have ideas about ourselves as readers, but when we put them to the test, we discover that our values are different there. The one thing that I did notice and was very intrigued by was the fact that stories seemed to be getting longer and more novelistic. I saw a lot of stories with multiple points of view, and stories like D.M. Perdidi that don't really focus on a moment but focus on the span of an entire life. And I thought that was an interesting glimpse of what's happening in the short story landscape right now. I think Alice Munro is the writer most responsible for opening up the story and bringing a variety of novelistic techniques into it.
That is a kind of a modern development, isn't it? I read that when you were trying to prepare yourself to do this, you went back and looked at the Best American Short Stories of 1986, which was edited by Raymond Carver. And I don't imagine in those days multiple points of view would have been common.
I think that probably at any given time you could find that there were writers working with multiple points of view. But I think it is just telling that I have a number of them in my collection, and Carver had none whatsoever. And I remember being in, you know, fiction workshops back in the 80s, and there really was a sense that, you know, a story had a main character and a single main event. That word single, I think, looms over the story. The earliest theorist of the short story was Poe, and his principle is that a story has a single effect. And, you know, you can see how he does that. His effects are always horror, and everything is contributing to that. And I think that really held up as a kind of objective for story writers for a long time. And I think only now people are starting to write stories that are really about more the sweep of a whole life or the interplay of a variety of characters rather than a single moment in the life of a single character.
I know that you chose 20 stories you are proud of. I have to ask, is there one you like the best?
I wouldn't want to single out one, but I think there are a couple of stories that really do qualify as masterpieces in here. Alice Munro's Axis is a story that I think anyone who wants to write fiction really needs to study, and just to see how a writer can compress the story of three intimately connected lives over the space of 50 years with just, you know, two or three anecdotes. It's really quite remarkable story. I think George Saunders' 10th of December is just an extraordinarily moving and funny story, and really a kind of a one-of-a-kind piece.
I'd like you to read just a little bit of one of the stories in the 2012 collection of the Best American Short Stories. What have you chosen for us?
I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of Julie Otsuka's story, D.M. Perdidi, which was originally published in Granta magazine. D.M. Perdidi by Julie Otsuka. She remembers her name. She remembers the name of the president. She remembers the name of the president's dog. She remembers what city she lives in, and on which street, and in which house. The one with the big olive tree where the road takes a turn. She remembers what year it is. She remembers the season. She remembers the day on which you were born. She remembers the daughter who was born before you. She had your father's nose. That was the first thing I noticed about her. But she does not remember that daughter's name. She remembers the name of the man she did not marry, Frank, and she keeps his letters in a drawer by the bed. She remembers that you once had a husband, but she refuses to remember your ex-husband's name. That man, she calls him. She does not remember how she got the bruises on her arm, or going for a walk with you earlier this morning. She does not remember bending over during that walk and plucking a flower from a neighbor's front yard and slipping it into her hair. Maybe your father will kiss me now. She does not remember what she ate for dinner last night or when she took her medicine. She does not remember to drink enough water. She does not remember to comb her hair. She remembers the rows of dried persimmon that once hung from the eaves of her mother's house in Berkeley. They were the most beautiful shade of orange. She remembers that your father loves peaches. She remembers that every Sunday morning at 10, he takes her for a drive down to the sea in the brown car. She remembers that every evening, right before the 8 o'clock news, he sets out 2 fortune cookies on a paper plate and announces to her that they are having a party. She remembers that on Mondays, he comes home from the college at 4, and if he is even 5 minutes late, she goes out to the gate and begins to wait for him. She remembers which bedroom is hers and which is his. She remembers that the bedroom that is now hers was once yours. She remembers that it wasn't always like this.
What I like about that story, I think, one of the many things that I like about that story, is that it seems to be only one thing and develops into another and another and another while maintaining the first story all the way through. It's a masterwork.
It really is. It's a tour de force. She hardly ever breaks from that, what seems like a really restrictive pattern of just she remembers, she doesn't remember. And yet, in the course of all those memories and forgettings, the reader slowly puts together a story of an entire life.
Yeah. Why do we read fiction?
In the introduction to the book, I was sort of talking about just that sort of cognitive excitement of reading good fiction. I really do feel like it's this sort of complex mental act that really kind of brings your whole person into this state of heightened alertness. I just feel like for those of us who love to do it, it's almost an addiction. I have to read some period every day. It's almost a form of meditation for me. I mean, it's the opposite of meditation where you empty your head. It's sort of like you enter some story and you're just fully engaged in a way that almost nothing else fully engages me. Certainly watching a movie is mesmerizing, but I don't always feel as fully engaged in a dialogue with a movie as I do with a book. So part of the reason we read is, I think, just for that intellectual and emotional excitement that comes from good fiction. And then I think there is a way in which, you know, when you're young, you read to learn about life. And even now, you know, I'm reading fiction to enter into the minds of characters that I might never meet or get a glimpse inside of cultures that I can only know from the outside. For those of us who love fiction, I think it really becomes our best way of understanding the world.
I'd really like to have you read an excerpt from one of your own short stories. What have you chosen for us?
I'm going to read from the opening of my short story, 9 Inches. It's the title story of a collection that's coming out in September. 9 Inches. Ethan didn't want to go to the middle school dance, but the vice principal twisted his arm. He said it was like jury duty. The system only made sense if everybody stepped up and nobody got special treatment. Besides, he added, you might as well do it now, get it over with before the new baby comes and things get even crazier. Ethan saw the logic in this, but it didn't make him feel any less guilty about leaving the house on Friday evening with the dishes unwashed and Fiona just getting started on her nightly meltdown. Apparently, her busy toddler day wasn't complete unless she spent an hour or two shrieking her head off before bedtime. Dana smiled coldly at him from the couch, as if he'd volunteered to be a chaperone out of spite, just to make her life that much more difficult. Don't worry about us, she called out as he buttoned his coat. We'll be fine. She had to speak in a louder than normal voice to make herself heard over Fiona, who was standing in the middle of the living room in yellow Dr. Denton's, her fists balled and her face smeared with a familiar glaze of snot, tears, and unquenchable fury. No, Daddy, she bellowed. You stay home. I'm sorry, Ethan said, not quite sure if he was apologizing to his wife or his child. I tried to get out of it. Dana scoffed, as if this were a likely story. She was usually a more understanding person, but this pregnancy wasn't bringing out the best in her. Only 5 months along, she'd already begun groaning like a martyr every time she hoisted herself out of a chair or bent down to tie her shoe. She was also sweating a lot, and her face had taken on a permanent pink flush, as if she were embarrassed by her entire life. Ethan couldn't say he was looking forward to the next several months, or the next several years, for that matter. Love you guys, he said, inching toward the door.
Tom Parada, reading from his short story, 9 Inches. Parada is the editor of the Best American Short Stories 2012. What do you think makes a great short story? You can let us know by sending an email through our website, ttbook.org. You can also reach us via Facebook or Twitter. Coming up, Karen Russell and her magical new collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, as we conclude our Hour on the Short Story. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Karen Russell isn't wasting any time making a name for herself in the literary world. Her debut novel, Swamplandia, was a finalist for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Russell was named a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree in 2009 for her first short story collection. Now she's released her second collection of short stories, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And Strange Champs talks with Karen Russell.
Karen, the short stories in this new collection, I read one description of them as the perfect blend of magic and reality. How does that description strike you?
Oh my goodness. The bar is high if you're saying perfect blend, right? I do like that. I like that it's some kind of Starbucks blend of magic and reality. I always feel a little uncomfortable, I guess, talking now, which I've been doing sort of a lot of yakking about fantasy and reality, like I believe they're binaries. You know, like I think that they're two discrete categories. I've sort of always been drawn as a reader to fiction where it's happening on a continuum, right? It gets really slippery. Whatever distinction between the real world and the imaginary one, it gets effaced. And I grew up in South Florida, right? I think the last time I was on the show I was talking about Florida, which is like a magical realist state.
Really? I was going to say a lot of people would think of that as the least magical place in America.
Well, that's probably true, too. But I think it was such a good instruction for a would-be fiction writer because you have all of these invented places, you know, theme parks, tiny diorama universes. In principle, anyway, Florida's big industry is fantasy. And then you have just the real strangeness of the geography, the ocean, the Everglades, and also just people living their real lives in this kind of surreal place. So I'm sure that whenever I talk about sort of fantasy and reality, I think about just my childhood home where it was anybody's guess where one line ended and the other began.
So you don't just write magical realism, you grew up in magical realism.
Every time people ask about magical realism and Marquez and the Latin Americans, I sort of think, yeah, there's a literary influence, but also it was just growing up where the parrot jungle was next to the grocery store, you know.
I read somewhere you described this kind of writing as an optical trick that lets you see something that you might not be aware of if you were reading about the same plot set in a mall in New Jersey.
Right.
What did you mean?
I'm glad I said that. That sounds right. Sometimes you get less flattering echoes back from interviews. It does feel a little bit like an optical trick because I think if you can set up the ratio of supernatural details to naturalistic details correctly, it's not that you're writing about a completely other realm. I sort of think of it as like a funhouse mirror. Flannery O'Connor has that fabulous quote, "For the blind, you draw large and startling figures." I must be a little myopic just in the world because I'm sort of drawn to writing these exaggerated, monstrously distorted versions of reality. But I think sometimes you can see a little more clearly, you know, some aspect of just the everyday gets dilated so you can see it. So, you know, with the title story, these vampires, sort of as a ridiculous premise there. The least sexy vampires in the world, this monogamous couple that are living in a lemon grove, they've discovered that they don't need to drink the blood to survive, but they do have this bottomless craving. They're still pretty afflicted, and they found that a temporary fix is to shove a lemon on their fangs. So that's sort of an insane premise, but it was a way for me to think about kind of a pretty universal predicament, right? When you discover that there's some myth that you don't have to hew to, but you continue to have a certain craving or some problematic recurring desire that's making your relationship difficult. So I guess that's a very long-winded answer to say often there's some way in which these stories, as kind of outrageous as the premises might seem, it lets me think about a pretty basic, pretty human question or problem.
That story, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, it's both magical and very realistic. Could you read a bit for us from that story?
Oh, definitely. Over the years, Maghreb and I have tried everything. Fangs in apples, fangs in rubber balls. We have lived everywhere. Tunis, Laos, Cincinnati, Salamanca. We spent our honeymoon hopping continents, hunting liquid chimeras. Mint tea in Fez. Coconut slurries in Oahu. Jet black coffee in Bogota. Jackal's milk in Dakar, cherry coke floats in rural Alabama, 1,000 beverages purported to have magical quenching properties. We went thirsty in every region of the globe before finding our oasis here in the blue boot of Italy at this dead nun's lemonade stand. It's only these lemons that give us any relief. When we first landed in Sorrento, I was skeptical. The pitcher of lemonade we ordered looked cloudy and adulterated. Sugar clumped at the bottom. I took a gulp, and a whole small lemon lodged in my mouth. There is no word sufficiently lovely for that first taste, the first feeling of my fangs in that lemon. It was bracingly sour with a delicate hint of ocean salt. After an initial prickling, a sort of chemical effervescence along my gums, a soothing blankness traveled from the tip of each fang to my fevered brain. These lemons are a vampire's analgesic. If you have been thirsty for a long time, if you have been suffering, then the absence of those two feelings, however brief, becomes a kind of heaven. I breathed deeply through my nostrils. My throbbing fangs were still. By daybreak, the numbness had begun to wear off. These lemons relieve our thirst without ending it, like a drink we can hold in our mouths but never swallow. Eventually, the original hunger returns. I have tried to be very good, very correct and conscientious about not confusing this original hunger with the thing I feel for Maghreb.
I have to confess, I'm a novel reader. I actually don't read a lot of short stories. I feel like I'm confessing that I'm not a very good reader, but I find them dissatisfying because just as I get attached to the characters, the whole thing's done. What do you think? What's good about a short story?
Yeah, I think a lot of readers have that experience. It's a different pleasure, right? I mean, I think a novel, there's something wonderful about being with characters over time. And I think some readers, if they're going to commit to a fictional universe, it's a lot of work. It's asking a lot more of readers than nonfiction. You have to assemble this entire imaginary world, right? You're not reading about crime in Detroit necessarily. You're reading about, you know, in the case of Saunders, some alternate world where Semplica girls are possible or escape from Spiderhead, or in this case where I'm asking everybody to imagine a lemon grove of recovering married vampires. So it's a lot of work for readers. It's a big ante. And I think some people, they just want the sustained pleasure of a novel to put down stakes there. But I also think there are many people who haven't read a short story since they were forced to in high school, since they had to read like the yellow wallpaper and write about its themes in a 15-minute block for some test. And the experience of reading a story collection as an adult is an amazing one. I mean, I didn't know that I liked stories until I went to college and was given Flannery O'Connor, Juno Diaz. And it is, it's true, the ending is going to feel maybe necessarily abrupt because you just met these people, you know, you just got oriented to their world and what, it's all over. But I think it can work in the best cases the way a joke or a poem does, where there's such a powerful impact. The thing is so compact, it's so kind of turbocharged. You can read it in one sitting. You can have this sort of seamless experience of it. So I hear you, Anne. I know a lot of people who are primarily novel people, but I like to advocate for the short story because it's its own special monster. It's sort of a beautiful form. I think it can infect readers in the best way. You can then be haunted by the ending in the best way, too, because it's not resolved in the same way a novel sometimes is.
Boy, that is such a natural segue into the second story in this book, which I have to say did stay with me for a very long time. And word to readers, don't read this one before bed. This is the one about the girls who sort of turn into silkworms.
Yeah, that is probably the most upsetting one in some ways.
What happens in it?
I loved writing that story. That felt like such a kind of new territory for me, I think. It was upsetting for me, too. There's some really uncomfortable stuff in this one. It's set during Meiji era Japan. The sort of historical bedrock for it is just there was this period of incredibly rapid industrialization where Japan is going from this isolated feudal nation to sort of its modern form. So the entire island is kind of shuddering with the velocity of this change. And then in a micro way, I was reading about the story of these daughters of tenant farmers who went to work as silk reelers in these new Western-style textile mills. So basically Western-style factories, and they were promised a really pretty glamorous and well-compensated life as sort of cotton spinners, silk reelers. In many cases, the actual history is pretty devastating. They are working 10-hour shifts and terrible conditions. And it was funny because reading this, it's not like you can dismiss it as some antiquated human rights violation. I think it has a lot of contemporary resonances for impoverished workers everywhere. So anyway, this is a very long windup, but the story ended up being about these daughters of farmers who are duped into going to work at a place called Nowhere Mill, a really nightmarish factory, and transformed into actual silkworms. So they're kind of compulsively producing silk.
But it's much more physical, more visceral than that. They drink this tea, or they're forced to drink this tea, and then it's as though the insides of their bodies sort of liquefy and turn into silk.
Yeah. It's a digestive horror story, right? There's a sort of a reproductive horror story in some ways, too, because they're gestating. They're like literally gestating the silk. And then they have to hook up to this machine to sort of, I don't know. I mean, it's so gross to talk about it.
You wrote it.
I know. Every time I read the jacket copy, it's so disorienting. I'm like, I did write that. How frightening.
Is there a bit of it you could read for us?
Yeah, let me do maybe just the, I'll put it bluntly paragraph, because
yeah,
that's sort of how gross it becomes. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll put it bluntly. We are all becoming reelers. Some kind of hybrid creature, part Kaiko silkworm caterpillar, and part human female. Some of the older workers' faces are already quite covered with a coarse white fur, but my face and thighs stayed smooth for 20 days. In fact, I've only just begun to grow the white hair on my belly. During my first nights and days in this silk reeling factory, I was always shaking. I have never been a hysterical person, and so at first I misread these tremors as mere mood. I was in the clutches of a giddy sort of terror, I thought. Then the roiling feeling became solid. It was the thread, a color purling invisibly in my belly. Silk. Yards and yards of thin color would soon be extracted from me by the machine.
That's so hideous and beautiful all at the same time.
Thanks.
And you know what's so effective about that is that it is both fantastical and grounded at the same time. I mean, the details are so concrete. Is that a very deliberate choice you make, kind of a way of making, I guess, the supernatural real?
You know, I do think so. And I think I've learned so much, or must, you know, by osmosis, because this was the stuff I love to read. People like Frank Herbert and Dune, or, you know, Calvino and Borges, or Kafka, certainly. So The Metamorphosis is such a great example of precise physical detail. I mean, it's scary and funny and a range of emotions when Gregor Samsa wakes up in that insect body. And I think, you know, he doesn't stop there. I mean, he's imagining, how would this really feel? What do his little legs look like twittering out of the corner of his new bug eyes? What does it feel like to have a hard shell back? What are you going to do when you're both worried that you're going to be late for work and you can't roll over on your exoskeleton and climb out of bed because you're a cockroach? So I was reading stuff where there's no switch in register. It's very matter of fact. The table and the bed and the picture frame are described in the same kind of detail as Gregor Samsa's new mandibles. For me, too, I think it wasn't such a stretch to sort of imagine, literally imagine, and to make concrete this silk growing inside these girls. In this story, it's really connected sort of to their memories and their emotional worlds. I think a lot of people have that, right, where an emotion feels like a concrete entity. It feels material, you know, like grief can feel like a rock in your gut. So it is. I just think it's sort of a natural way for me to think about the materiality of emotions in the past, too, mm-hmm. just the weight they can carry.
So I was thinking that this theme we've been talking about that's kind of running through here about the mutability of stories, but also about that transformation from the imaginary into concrete physical reality. I was thinking, of course, it's such a perfect theme for a writer, because that's what you do, right? When you're sitting down in front of a piece of paper, you're taking the imaginary world that's in your head and making it concrete.
Right, hopefully. And in such collaboration with readers, sometimes I think it's almost like all we're doing is writing a score. And then whatever happens inside the reader's brain is some completely private symphony. You know, there's something so spooky and amazing about that to me. You know, now, having gotten to meet some readers, and you realize how different whatever world they assembled, you know, out of those words might look or feel.
It's almost like the readers are the ghosts.
Yeah, a little bit. That's like not an attractive metaphor, but I do think it's this way. You want to virally inhabit this other person's body. You want to make a good delivery system. the work that, yeah, a fiction writer is doing, that makes it sound kind of malevolent to say a virus. But, you know, maybe like music, right? It's on a page that somebody else is going to embody.
We welcome your imaginary ghosts inside our heads.
Thanks, Anne.
Karen Russell is the author of the short story collection Vampires in the Lemon Grove. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. And we have just enough time to hear Karen Russell read an excerpt from another one of her stories. This one's called The New Veterans. It's about a massage therapist named Beverly who discovers she has the power to heal by manipulating a war veteran's tattoos.
At 3:45, Beverly begins to wind down. She makes a few last long strokes along his spine's meridian. Time's up, she's about to say, when she notices something stuck beneath her pinky. When she moves her hand, she slides the thing across the sky on Zeiger's shoulder, still tethered to her finger like a refrigerator magnet. Only it's flat. It's inside the tattoo. No, she thinks, impossible, as she continues to float it around his upper back, an orange circle no larger than a grocery sale sticker. It's the sun. Beverly swallows hard and blinks as if that might correct the problem. She draws her pinky halfway down his spine, and the sun moves with it. When she lifts her little finger, the sun stays put. She can't stop touching it, like an idiot child at a stovetop. Well, this is trouble. This is a real madhouse puzzle. The sun slides around, but the rest of the tattoo stays frozen. The cows stare at the grass, unalarmed, as it zings comet-like over their horns. The soldiers' faces remain stiffly turned to the west, war blasé, as the sun grazes their helmets. She gasps, just once, and Sergeant Zeiger says in a polite voice, "Thank you, ma'am. That feels nice." "Time is up," Ed raps at the door. "Bev, you got a 4:00.
Karen Russell, with an excerpt from The New Veterans, a story from her new collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program The Short Story. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.